on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hi there, welcome. Thanks for joining us. During the past week, reports of assaults on members of the Indian student community, firstly in Melbourne and then in Sydney, have raised Indian media concerns about Australian attitudes. They've been picked up by other media around the world. Attitudes. It is, of course, code for attitudes to race, a continuing sub-theme in Australian political debate, notwithstanding the demise of the White Australia Scheme more than a generation ago. And that's where we're headed tonight. It was an issue that during the Howard years shadowed the debate over asylum seekers and was most evident in the use of language. People fleeing desperate situations in their homelands were no longer refugees but illegal aliens. The boat people of the Vietnam era became people smuggled onto our shores. Words linked to desperation and courage became linked instead to fear and threat. And both sides of politics have played the game. Being tough on border protection is part of the rhetoric of winning electoral office. Well, in a few moments, we'll be joined by a panel from both sides of the continent to take up the discussion on asylum seekers and our attitudes today. Are we still using border protection as a cover for darker attitudes? And how do we treat the stranger and the refugee in our midst? You can participate in the conversation by giving us a call on the number I'll give you in a few minutes' time. In our second hour this evening, a traveller of a rather different sort, someone who's made the long pilgrimage from the closed environment of a Catholic convent in the early 60s to priesthood in the Anglican Church. The journey of a lifetime, as described by our guest, one of Australia's growing band of women priests, Loy Thompson, in about an hour's time. Then the regular bits and pieces, the Midnight Inquisition, Noel's Quest for the Good Life, some music for Trinity Sunday, and then a chat room, by way of a touch of irony. Our guest this evening, a new one from the Unitarian Church, the Reverend Peter Ferguson. On ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world, John Cleary with you. And as the recent spate of people smuggling demonstrates, it doesn't take much to stir concerns in Australia about border protection. Both sides of politics need to be seen to be tough. But what of those who come seeking refuge and our understanding of what it is to be a refugee? Are we full of soft-headed compassion? Or are our attitudes more akin to realistic protection? And is that the only choice? Well, it's a pleasure to welcome into our studios this evening three people from different sides of the continent who are dealing with these issues on a daily basis. In our Perth studios, from CARAD, the Coalition for Asylum Seekers, Refugees and Detainees, the chairperson, Rosemary Hudson-Miller, and worker Phil Sparrow. And in our Melbourne studios, Kaz Coleman of the Uniting Church Hotham Mission Asylum Seeker Project. Welcome to you all.
Thanks, John.
Thank you. Rosemary Hudson-Miller, let me come to you first. The people caught in the dreadful fire aboard the boat last month, what's the latest on their situation?
Well, most of them are out of hospital and in a community detention centre here and are being visited by members of their community and seeing their migration agent and being cared for.
And what sort of status are they being given?
Well, you'll understand that the first priority for them, for the government, was to get their health status developed.
So yes, and I guess some are still in hospital, are they not?
Yeah, only just a few, or one maybe. But I haven't got up-to-date stats on that from today. But only last week they were being beginning the process of the migration or refugee claims that they're lodging.
Phil Sparrow, what were the attitudes generally expressed around town in that? Take us back to that week of that dreadful event and the attitudes that have been expressed to these people since. Did it initially regenerate all the old sort of shibboleths about illegal aliens and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera?
You know, John, it's a little difficult for me to answer that because at the time we were only back from Afghanistan for about 1 week. We'd been in Afghanistan up until late March, and I don't remember exactly when the when that occurred, but I guess it must have been early April. But I did hear quite quickly from a number of people, oh, you know, Afghans coming here again, boat people being smuggled. Just the words and phrases and terminology that I hadn't heard for many years very quickly rose up again. Now, I don't think I heard too many people saying, you know, illegal aliens, queue jumpers, which were some of the more pejorative terms that were around in, 2000, 2001, which I was glad to hear because the whole queue jumping language and the illegals language was particularly nasty. And I didn't hear too much of that, which I was glad of.
Yes, and I'd like to return to some of those issues before. Kaz Coleman from the Hotham Asylum Seekers Project in Melbourne, welcome to you.
Thank you, John.
Kaz, on a separate but in some ways related issues, this week, of course, there's been problems experienced and expressed in the press and on our television news with migrant communities of students from India. And I heard a story last week that some Indian students had been forced to sleep rough in Melbourne because of the difficulties they've been experiencing. Those sort of things, I know it's a separate issue, but in some way it's related. Are those sort of things been coming across your desk at Hotham over recent months? Have you become aware of these sorts of issues?
Well, I guess delightfully, I've actually been on leave in the last week, so it certainly hasn't hit my desk in the last week. But I guess you're asking fundamentally about an increase in racism and the impact that might have for our clients.
Yes, and I was talking to a social worker in Melbourne last week who said that they'd been sufficiently concerned about the issue a couple of months ago to begin to set up emergency accommodation services that would embrace members of the Indian student community.
Well, that's certainly a great concern because for anybody who knows about emergency accommodation services in Melbourne and indeed around the country, they're extremely rare. Certainly that's part of the work that we do is finding housing for people who have no safe and secure housing or no income to access it. So certainly if that's a task they're undertaking, I wish them luck. I mean, I guess in terms of the question you originally asked about an increase perhaps in prejudice, both in the broader community and perhaps for our clients, I mean, I think the difference for the people we work with, asylum seekers in the community, and I should point out that actually India is one of the top three countries of asylum claims that Australia received in 2008. And indeed, that's reflected in our numbers. The people we work with, it's one of the top three countries.
Why is
that? We work with. A range of reasons. I mean, there'd be different scenarios. They're not. It's not a significantly large number in the sense that it's only 349 people last year, and you compare that to some of the other numbers such as China and Sri Lanka and it's significantly lower. But I think, as I mentioned, I've not been in a position to talk to our Indian clients over the last couple of weeks. But I mean, I think generally for asylum seekers, where there's no connection with the community, and I mean when there's no ability to work either through no permission to work or not able to gain employment, work is a very strong connection to the community. And for those students and workers who have strong connections, I suspect they'll be experiencing that to a greater degree. They'll be coming into contact with people daily. Our clients, if you can say fortunately, won't be as much because unfortunately their social connections are very limited, particularly for those who can't work, can't study, that kind of experience.
What sort of numbers are we talking about here over a year?
In terms of asylum applications?
Yeah.
Well, the interesting thing about asylum seekers, when you talk about that in Australia, a majority come by plane. So in 2008, we had around 4,700 applications for asylum in Australia. Now, when you look at the numbers who arrived by boat, it was 148. So you can do the maths and look at those who arrive by plane, and it's much higher. It's
yet all the attention tends to go towards the boat
That's
people,
right.
And they're those who are most desperate and perhaps have the best justification for being termed legitimate refugees.
That's right. And in actual fact, those arriving by boat traditionally have a higher acceptance rate in terms of their refugee applications. So you're right, John, that there is, I guess, a higher rate of acceptance, but they also come by a far more dangerous route. I mean, coming by plane implies that one has a visa and has cleared immigration and come in that way. So I think we need to put it in perspective when we talk about asylum seekers in Australia, and that is to balance the view of those who come by boat and those who arrive by plane.
Rosemary Hudson-Miller, dealing with the coalfaces who have been in Perth over recent years, how long has CARID been in operation in Perth, and what prompted the initial coming together of those groups who formed CARID?
Well, the initial impetus was the late 99 boats arriving here, and then in early 2000, people were brought down on buses from Port Hedland and Curtin and released into the Perth community with 3 days, enough money to stay at a backpackers for 3 days and no supports. And, of course, the TPVs had been implemented here.
These are temporary protection visas.
Temporary protection visas, that's right. And in the very early days of the temporary protection visas, there were very minimal grants of visas, and so people had really huge difficulties in surviving.
Just hold you there for a minute, because you're very familiar with this stuff.
I am.
But to talk about people coming down from a place like Port Hedland, which is sort of isolated up there as a desert community after having come across the Torres Straits or the Arafura Sea or wherever they'd come across from Indonesia, they land in Perth and are given enough money for 3 days. What did the government expect would happen to them?
Well, it's not entirely clear to me what they thought would happen, but perhaps they hadn't really thought it through.
I think that's abundantly clear.
the agencies in Perth who were the churches and other concerned community people who'd worked with refugees over a number of years were pretty alive to the fact that we needed to be responding to this need that we saw immediately obvious, and so came together and formed CARID. And there's a limited Perth is a small place, there's a limited community sector and the non-government sector, and a lot of the previously other organisations who were funded through the Department of Immigration or DEMA at that time, they've changed their name so many times, but the Immigration Department had specifically forbidden any of the agencies that received their funding from assisting the temporary protection visa holders.
Oh, I see. So those agencies most concerned with the welfare of those were the same agencies who were specifically excluded from assisting.
Well, all of the funded agencies were told that they weren't to use any of their funding for that, and it was a kind of an intimidating time for the non-government sector in Australia all over. I think you probably remember that.
Well, it was used in the employment area too.
It was the same kind of modus operandi, and everybody knew what that meant, and it did mean that agencies who were doing good work with the humanitarian visa entrants were not able to assist, or agencies that are not dependent on the government, particularly the churches bringing reasonable funding to these kinds of, or an ability to kind of use its constituency to raise money to do those things. So the churches in Western Australia came together, including the Anglican Catholic Uniting Churches of Christ, Lutheran Baptists, everyone was very, very generous in that time, and the Quakers and so on, and everyone was really, really engaged and came together and pulled this organisation together in a very chaotic time. And there were hundreds of people arriving each week here in Perth at that time. I think the thing that really got us going is 147 people arrived one weekend. It always happens on a Friday night. I think that they exist to destroy my Friday nights at the Department of Immigration.
Well, what you say there, I mean, it's appalling to talk about it, albeit 3 or 4 years removed, or 4 or 5 years removed. Let's bring ourselves up to date. the sorts of regulations or impositions you mention are things which can only be tolerated in a certain climate. And that climate probably extends over two groups. One would want to talk about, and that is, first of all, the general community climate that would allow those attitudes to go largely unchallenged, except by the vocal few. But secondly, and this is where I'd like to focus for the moment, on the departmental level, the Department of Immigration, have attitudes changed in the last, through your recent experience with this last group of refugee arrivals? Because the Rudd government has certainly been noisy about border protection, but there's a different issue there. We'll talk about the politics in a minute, but just the culture within the department.
I think it's really evident that the culture within the department has changed enormously, and I think it did start to change, to be fair to those officers, during the latter years of the Howard government. And many
this was
people,
after the Cornelia Rau and Vivian Solon cases.
That's right. And really, you'd have to say after Senator Vanstone became the minister, there was a change in some of those attitudes and so on, and it was around that time and so on. But there were always good people in the Department of Immigration, and many of whom were so helpful and so kind working in a system that was horrid to work in and traumatizing for the staff that stayed in there, and many of those people faithfully stayed in there because they thought if they didn't, worse things would happen for the asylum seekers. So, you know, I want to acknowledge those people, but in general, there's been a huge change in the attitude of the department from top to bottom, I'd say now.
Kaz Coleman, was that your experience in Melbourne?
Yes, I'd certainly concur with what Rosemary said, and I think it did begin before this current government was in leadership. I would like to comment on two things Rosemary said. I think she's made a really good point in terms of why, I think it was in response to your question, John, as to why more people perhaps don't know about it or have accepted the views or the actions in terms of temporary protection visa holders, for instance, being dumped in cities, or asylum seekers who are given no permission to work and no Medicare. I mean, I think two of the biggest things that carried and Holtham Mission Asylum Seeker Project face is that there's no money in this. There's no government money for us to apply for, even if we wanted to.
Still and no money for you to apply for?
Not at this stage. And so the work that we do relies on community funding. It relies on hundreds and thousands of people to donate to us, philanthropic bodies, all of our funding, and I'm sure all CARAD's funding comes from the community. And so for larger organisations, and as Rosemary pointed out, some larger organisations were threatened with having their government funding pulled if they did assist this group. And so we've really been marginalised in terms of service delivery for a long time. The second thing that's really difficult is that the people we work with are often, certainly for Holtham Mission, the people we work with are still in process. So you legally and ethically, and I guess in terms of the vulnerability of people, it's very difficult to use people's stories and faces, which is what the media wants, to be able to tell people about these actions and what's happening in the community around destitution.
Yes, the media naturally wants to humanise things.
They do. And
sometimes demonise, but most occasions humanise.
That's right. And I could, you know, count the number of times we've been approached by media, and yet we just can't offer a face to go with perhaps the story. We can offer case studies and, of course, stock photos. But it's very difficult to get the message out when people are very vulnerable and there's not a lot of funding in this. In fact, I don't know about CARAD, but we're certainly experiencing a drop in donations, and that impacts on the ground. We've just had to cut 60 people off their $33 a week that we give them, and that's their only form of income.
So you've been giving people, because they can't get government support in any way, you've
that's
been giving
right.
people, some people, $33 a week
That's right.
Tiny enough to get them meals for a day, perhaps.
That's right.
And you've had to cut them out of that. So what are they getting now?
Nothing.
So we still are facing a situation in which people who are refugees in the old sense of the word, asylum seekers perhaps, or whatever the new terminology is, facing a very desperate situation whilst their circumstances are sorted out.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, I think the government has done a really great job at advancing some of these issues. You know, I certainly would say there's been some really promising issues that have been addressed and some conversation about more to come. But it's been difficult to change things, I think, in a short period of time, over a protracted period of time where people have been left destitute in the community or in detention. And so we still do have a way to go. There are some really good things that were announced in the last federal budget, in particular an expansion of something called the Community Care Pilot, which actually started out of the Howard government and has been continued and now expanded under this government. But we also know that it's still not going to be big enough. It's a good start.
Yes. Phil Sparrow, I'd like to come to you by way of two things. One, what your experience on the ground of the circumstances that people are in at the moment, for example, have what's the situation regarding some of the worst excesses that we recall of the camps and other things that were established for people, but also your experience of the other end of the pipeline in Afghanistan. But first, just incidentally, have any observations about the situation here now that Gaza's referring to, and particularly with regard to the camps and other things?
Well, it's my understanding that the situation in the... You're talking about the camps in Australia?
Yes.
Yes. I mean, I think they've improved quite radically from the dark days. Mm. Some camps have shut down. And
we don't have the situation where kids are suffering isolation.
No. I mean, the kids are minors are now housed in the community rather than kept in the camps. Unaccompanied minors and families are attempted to be kept together and so on. So I think there's been a much more humane approach.
Yes, go on. Finish
There's still a long way to go. I mean, when you've started or when you've been in such a bad situation as we were, roughly 10 years ago. Any improvement's great, but, that just highlights that we've still got a long way to go. And I just want to make a very quick contrast. When Canada was faced with a refugee, numbers of people arriving by, let's say, illegal means or by boat or I don't know how they arrive in Canada, but, crossing borders without Irregular means. Canada launched, under the leadership of the government, launched a program called Canada, Everybody's Welcome, which was a fantastic example of humane leadership. And sort of everybody followed their lead and said, yeah, everybody's welcome. Canada's big enough. Whereas I think, we had in Australia this much more miserly, fearful, terrorizing approach to what is, as Kaz has pointed out, a very small, issue, the numbers of people arriving via boat. And, we are improving, but, gosh, there's a long way to go.
Do you think it's still Australians are still capable of responding to the visceral dog whistle when it sounded?
Oh, absolutely. I think we're so isolated in Australia. This is one of the things that hits me when we come back to Australia from where we've lived for a long time in Afghanistan. It's just how isolated Australians are from these types of issues. We don't share borders with any other country, so we've never really grappled with the issue of people seeking, cross-border movements, which most other countries in the world do daily. Lots of countries, people cross borders every single day, legally, illegally, and the populations are attuned to it. We're not here. And I think there's just a subtle linguistic shift that I want to point out as well. We used to talk about border control and refugee protection. And it's good to protect refugees because they're a population group that needs protection, and borders should be controlled, managed. Mm. The change has been from border control and refugee protection to refugee control and border protection. And that's a subtle but very significant difference, and it hasn't changed from that yet. We're still talking about protecting borders and really controlling refugees in a lot of ways. And I think, you know, the day I want to see is for us to switch back to protecting groups of people that are most vulnerable, like refugees.
Yes, and it's going to take not the sort of subtle sleight of hand shift, but perhaps the paradigm shift, such as a move to the Canadian model.
Yeah, it's not just a linguistic shift now that's required, although that would be welcome, but it's an attitudinal shift. Perhaps I can just give a couple of examples of what we saw in Afghanistan
Let me amplify that with you. Let's talk about that. Track for us, Phil Sparrow, the journey of somebody in Afghanistan, their plight in Afghanistan, how it is they manage to wheedle their way out of that country along that dreadful trail into Australia, which sometimes finds them adrift on the seas and the victim sometimes of people smugglers.
Well, let me start with a very real example. In it must have been about October of last year, and it went pretty well unremarked by any press, any media that I could see. In the central Afghanistan highlands, the Hazarajat, where most of the Hazara people come from, who are the main ethnic group who sought refugee status in Australia in recent years. In the central Hazarajat, the Pashtun nomads, the Kuchis, which is another ethnic group, and who have traditional grazing rights in those areas. But you know, there's an agreement, and a relatively amicable agreement between the Hazaras who live there year-round and the Kuchi nomads who come up there seasonally. Well, the Kuchi nomads decided in October of last year that they wanted more land, and under the blind eye of the government and the government soldiers and military and police, these nomads marched into Hazara villages and burnt them to the ground, killed the men, assaulted many women, and burned the villages. And in a period of about 1 month, 40,000 Hazara families, mostly without the men left, washed into Kabul. Now, that is still going on. It was unremarked by the press at large, as far as I could tell. But they couldn't go back. Their men were dead and their lands were seized. Now, that's the beginning of a journey to a leaky boat. For many of the refugees, that sort of event, you know, people end up destitute from that. And I guess the next step is to decide which of your family which of your remaining family, the eldest son probably, you want to try to send out of the country, generally via Pakistan or perhaps sometimes Iran, and who then make their way across to Indonesia. We've met many families in Afghanistan who said, "Oh yeah, my uncle or my brother-in-law went to Australia on a boat, tried to get there, and yes, he made it." You know, eventually they'll tell us he did make it. He spent some time in the camps, and the amazing thing is they're still profoundly grateful for the whole experience, which must have been a terrifying one. But they're still profoundly grateful that their brother or their brother-in-law or whoever it was actually made it and is now in Australia. You know, the grace shown by these people is inspiring.
Let's talk about some of the other myths that surround this area briefly. But before we do, I'll let you know at home that you can give us a call on Sunday night. 1-300-800-222 is the number, 1-300-800-222. Australians' attitude to asylum seekers. Have we changed? Are we changing? Should we change? Do you think we should be tougher on border protection? Should we still be fearful of asylum seekers and people smugglers? What do you think is the correct response? Have we been mean, stingy to those around the world who are really in desperate need? Have politicians really been using the sufferings of a very small group to advance their own narrow political causes? Do give us a call, 1-300-800-222, anywhere you are around Australia. We'd like to hear from you. Our guests on Sunday night, Rosemary Hudson-Miller and Phil Sparrow of CARAD in Western Australia, and Kaz Coleman of the Hotham Asylum Seekers Project in Melbourne, and you can join us. Let's talk about a couple of these other attitudinal things. Rosemary Hudson-Miller, myths around this sort of stuff abound. Phil mentioned that dreadful trail out of Afghanistan and other places. One of the things that's been said in the past is, look, these people are queue jumpers. What they should do is register properly at the point of exit from their own country, and then they can be handled through proper processes, because if they don't, what happens is people who do go through proper processes fall out of the queue and these queue jumpers take their place. Is that a realistic description of anything?
No, it isn't. And there aren't any queues. And if there were queues, you can't get onto them. You know, there's nowhere to register seek asylum in Australia in the Australian Embassy in Islamabad.
There's no embassy in Kabul anymore.
No embassy in Kabul.
Australian embassy closed down.
No embassy in Kabul, and the places where you can seek asylum are just so few and far between, and the problems that face people in those areas are just horrendous. We know about these things because we have had to try and get last remaining members of families of, you know, the last child that got left behind or whatever it is, through to Australia when we finally found them. And we know how difficult it is for anybody to get anywhere near the Australian Embassy in Islamabad. And that's, you know, that some of that journeys have taken 18 months for us to negotiate with the cooperation of the Department of Immigration. You know, so it's a huge problem. The other problem is that we are very sheltered, as Phil's already alluded to, in Australia. We just don't have to face this daily humanitarian crisis across any of our borders. And just recently we've had people seeking asylum from Sri Lanka. Now, we all know that that's been a humanitarian disaster there, and that the UNHCR and the UN as a whole is trying to provide some assistance. There is no way that anyone can be providing assistance in that country at this time. So there's no
assistance
there.
But the Sri Lankan
there.
Government won't allow aid agencies to provide assistance to the Tamils.
Well, they're making it very extremely difficult to provide anything.
So how are people getting out?
So people are leaving the shores on boats, some of them. I mean, lots of people from Sri Lanka are seafaring people, and they live on an island like we do, and they've come on some of those boats, and they've sent the people who most need to seek asylum. So, you know, but there's no safe place for anyone to apply for asylum in Sri Lanka at the moment. Can you imagine popping down to Colombo to say, look, I just don't feel unsafe in this country anymore? It's just a ridiculous thing. You know, I'm sure people do get it when they actually sit down and think about it. But I do think that people are a bit more aware of some of these things now. And I do think that the media have played a really nice role, a really supportive role in telling people's stories and so on in these circumstances.
Kaz Coleman, before we take some calls, so let me ask some practical questions. Mm. What are your principal aims now? That is, one, for government policy change, two, for immediate assistance from the public, and three, the daily concerns that you have and you face.
Well, I'll start answering them with the latter. I guess the daily needs we have are really financial, in the sense of the only way that we can deliver financial aid, emergency relief, house people in their housing. We provide free housing. People donate housing to us very generously to be able to house asylum seekers for free. So we pay for utilities. You know, the $33 a week that we give to people is hardly a living wage, but that costs us anywhere between $20,000 and $30,000 a month. So I guess our greatest need really is finances from the community, and we feel very grateful for those when we receive them. In terms of government policy, I think there are a number of things in conversation that we would really like to see come to fruition. Some of those include, as I mentioned before, the community care pilot is becoming a program. We're very keen to see just how much that can be expanded. It's unlikely it will cover everyone who's needed, An example would be that we work with 350 people across a year. In the last 3 years, we've had 20 successful referrals into that program, and that's a government-funded program. Mm-hmm. So even with a slight expansion, it's unlikely that we'll be able to close our doors. We'll still be around for the next few years. The other change that's coming up, we're looking forward to a possible change in permission to work so that asylum seekers can, with skills, seek employment. I know it's a very difficult time at the moment, but a group of agencies did a skill audit of our clients a few years ago, and we're actually doing another one now. And we found that 70% of those we interviewed had skills on the skilled migration list. 40% had skills on the skilled in demand list. So we're not talking about a group of people who, can't become independent and actually strive for themselves while they're in a lawful process. We need to see those things happening so that there's less money the government needs to spend and there's less money the community needs to raise. Mm.
You're on Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia and via the web to the world. Our discussion point, asylum seekers. The recent return of a wave of boat people to Australia. What's been the attitude? A changed attitude? Have your attitudes changed? Do you think it's still a matter of border protection first? Or do you think we actually need to open our doors much wider? Do you think these are attitudinal issues which are very deep, or they are the result of just contemporary political manipulation? 1300 800 222 around Australia. We're taking your calls right now. Let's go to Stan in Sydney. Hello, Stan. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
Well, I just consider these people illegal immigrants. And because they have money, they're queue jumpers. The refugees that are waiting in camps to come to Australia are pushed further back because these people come. Now, I believe that the Navy should be empowered to turn these boats back to Indonesia or to Sri Lanka, so that these people get it in their minds that they can't queue jump.
Queue jumping, still an issue. Rosemary Hudson-Miller, you explained your attitude to this before. Do you want to just say a word to Stan again about that?
Well, the issue is actually that the camps in lots of Africa have actually been closed now, and we've resettled a lot of people here in Australia. We've got some camps still on the border of Burma in Thailand, and those people need to be resettled, and they're part of our humanitarian refugee intake now. So we are accepting those people, but there is nowhere for these other people to queue. There are no safe camps for them. There's no clean water and places, things where people can actually be looked after by the UNHCR and so on. So there's nowhere for them to go at the moment. There's nowhere for anybody from Sri Lanka to go at the moment that's safe for them.
So there are no queues in effect.
That's right. There are no queues for these people.
Stan, what do you think of that?
Well, I still think that they shouldn't be permitted because there are enough refugees, genuine refugees, not illegal immigrants, to satisfy the numbers that we should take. I don't care whether Sri Lanka hasn't got processing points or anything like that.
About 97% of the people... between 90 and 97% of the people who've been assessed under our rules have actually been recognised as being refugees, and that's under the UN Convention on Refugees. So they are not migrants. They're refugees. They haven't got an option. They're people who are fleeing from something, and that's they're the people who we're assisting. And it's a very small number, as Kaz has already pointed out.
Stan, we are going to have to move on. Thanks for your call. Got more calls on the board. Graham in Ormond in Victoria. Hello, Graham. Welcome to you. What would you like to say?
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I admit to being an ageing bit of a xenophobe. I do worry that there are a lot of people really who would love to come to this country for any reason whatsoever and possibly even claim refugee status. And the problem too when they come here is we tend to dump them into lower socioeconomic areas where in some cases they have to deal with other groups who are in the same situation, and you do get a level of tension that does arise, and that also can cause a bit of disquiet in the community. How you deal with that one, I don't know.
Kaz Coleman.
Look, I think in terms of, I guess the last part of Graham's question in terms of the way people come to Australia and where they end up, I mean, I think the challenge with the group that we work with, and again, this is different to the humanitarian program that Rosemary referred to, the reality is when you're left in destitution for long periods of time, you can't work, you can't provide for your family. One in five of our clients are children living in the community with no form of safe housing, no food security. If you leave people in that position for long periods of time, you will end up with mental health issues, and perhaps some issues where there's a difficulty in socially engaging if they are eventually allowed to stay. So it's actually not conducive for us to treat people badly whilst they're in process. It's much healthier for us to, once people arrive, allow them to be financially independent until their claim has been processed. If they can stay, then they are settled. If they can't, then they're returned home. I missed the first part of Graham's question. John, can you remind me?
Graham.
No, I think I said I'm a bit of a xenophobic old Australian. And I also wondered how Canada opened its doors to so many and how many flooded into Canada when they opened their doors.
Well, what I can comment on, and Rosemary, you might be able to enlighten us more, but last year Canada had nearly 37,000 applications for asylum. So whether or not that campaign Phil increased that number, I'm not sure. But comparatively, I mean, Canada deal with a far greater number of applications than we do. And I think if they're able to do it in a positive way, it's just another sign to show that we can too. And really, you know, this is a small problem for us. It's the numbers that are coming in are minor compared to other countries. As I mentioned, Canada, Italy, 31,000, New Zealand, New Zealand's very small. It's hard to get New Zealand too. They only got 250 last year. But the US, it's 49,000, the UK, 30,000. I mean, it's hard to get to Australia, as Phil said. And the offshore humanitarian program that Rosemary mentioned is crucial. We do need to take people from refugee camps. It's not a good situation for people to live in those camps for long periods of time, particularly not children and women, unaccompanied women. Our offshore refugee and humanitarian program is an excellent program, and we need to, in fact, I believe, expand it vastly. The federal government expanded it by 250 places for this year, so it's now at 13,500. We do need that program, and I think Graham and Stan would agree with that. But we also need to deal with the problem at our doorstep, and that is that people will come. There's no point, I think, in closing our eyes to the problem in front of us. Mm. It's a matter of how we deal with it and dealing with it well.
You're on Sunday Night. Do give us a call, 1300 800 222. Thank you very much for your call, Graham. We're going to have to move on to Irene in Canberra. Hello, Irene. Welcome.
Hi, John. The main reason why people don't want refugees or migrants coming here, well, the difference between Australia and Canada is Australia's in Asia. I mean, we are surrounded by people, and our climate similar to theirs. So Canada, I'd say, would be the last resort. Thanks very much.
Thanks for your observations. We'll just take that as an observation and move on to Jane in Bega. Hello, Jane.
Hello, good evening.
What would you like to say?
Well, I'd like to say that we have got a problem of bringing migrants into the country, not that I'm a racist in any way, but we have a problem with water. We cannot grow what we need if our water runs out, and we're bringing them in thousands, and then we have to feed them, we're going to end up in the same problems that they are.
Is that a comment about migration in general as much as it is about refugees?
Migration, well, mostly we don't get many refugees, only mostly...
So you're making a general point about migration?
Yes, yeah. And apart from that, their living standards are different to us, and what I've found from watching and being in the cities where all our refugees end up, is that they do not want to become Australians. They bring all their troubles with them. Most of their troubles are religious, and then in 20 years' time, we'll be having their fights here over what they think is their way of life is right.
We used to say that about the Irish. Then we said it about the Italians. Then we said it about the Greeks. Then we said it about the Vietnamese.
Oh, yes, but they're different people to what we're talking about with these refugees. I mean, okay. These are people that have lived very sparsely and very in a low category for so long, and dog-eat-dog attitude that they don't know anything different.
Phil Sparrow, you're somebody who's lived in this sort of circumstance. How do you respond to what Jane's saying?
Well, probably I'd have to disagree with some of your concerns, or perhaps suggest that your concerns are ill-founded. You know, I agree that many of the people coming to Australia via boat or who otherwise lodge a claim for protection here come from troubled countries. Of course they come from troubled countries, but they're fleeing those countries to escape the troubles. And most of them aren't interested in reigniting any of those troubles here. You know, they're keen to make a contribution to follow the rules of the land, the law of the land, you know. And I just yesterday we were at a park down by the river here in Western Australia. It was a beautiful day, and I was there with my wife and our three kids, and there were, I think, three other families, two of whom, or three of maybe all of the other families, were clearly from relatively recent arrivals. That is, they were speaking languages other than English as their preferred language. Two of them were speaking Arabic, the families, and the other one I couldn't work out. But I watched these families playing with their kids, enjoying the parks and the sunshine and the fantastic things here that we have on offer. And I just thought, these guys are going to make great Australians. They're, you know, they've come here to make a new life. They don't want to go back to their old life of strife. And I really think, you know, give them a few years, they'll maybe the colour of their skin's different, but the, you know, the heartbeat's just the same.
Let's say hi to Keith in Bunbury. Jane, thanks for your call, and hello, Keith. Welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for the opportunity. John, I reflect back on those times. They are some of the saddest times I can recall. And I think about John Howard, and I think about the control he had over his cabinet and over the departments that we've seen some of the, you know, some of the comments tonight have been, even the departments have been put in a no-win sort of situation. And the press actually weren't very helpful in those times, in that they, even the ABC went along with some of this, some of the language that was put around, but it was almost, I thought it was very, very cynical. I can't believe, actually, that so many people are actually anti allowing a safe haven for people. I mean, when was the last time, terrorists swept through Canberra and killed half of John Howard's family and threatened to come back and kill him the next day? And what would he do?
Yes, you're reflecting on a past that we may be moving away from, but not quickly enough for you.
Well, not really, no. And the language is still there. I noticed that the ABC has changed their language a little bit, but it's still, I mean, even our current PM, I know he's trying to do the right thing, but, when he went on about these people smugglers who wanted them to rot in hell, I mean, those people smugglers, you know, I don't know the whole story, and neither does he, but any port in a storm, basically, you're really, if your alternative is death, you know, go back to World War II and the people who smuggled Jews out of Germany. These were heroes, some of them.
Keith, we're going to have to wind it up. Thanks for your comments. It's been great to have you all with us. Rosemary Hudson-Miller, I gave Kaz a chance to outline the immediate couple of things she'd like to to have. Speaking for CARAD, what would be the, if you've got 30 seconds, what would
we
be
have the same We have the same needs as the Hotha Mission. Of course, we provide about half of the financials outgoing per month that Hotham do. So they've got a bigger program than us, but we put out about 10,000 a month, and that's our biggest need.
And Kaz Coleman, you've got a book coming out.
We have, yes. It's been 2 years in the making.
Tell us the name.
It's called Finding Shelter, and we're selling it as a fundraiser for us, so we'd love you to buy one. It's a history within the voices, or using the voices of asylum seekers.
We'll have to wind it up there. Kaz Coleman, Phil Sparrow, Rosemary Hudson-Miller, thanks for joining us on Sunday night. You can join the chat room a little later on Sunday night.